Of all the classes that we're doing this week, this one is extraordinarily visual. If we could open up to Ezekiel chapter 40. And before we continue on, we're going to review this statement. The kingdom of Christ will be a resurrection kingdom, having for its supreme potentate a resurrected heir to the throne, and for its house of lords a multitude of resurrected princes, priests, and prophets, and for its home rule a politically resurrected nation, and for its empire a socially and religiously regenerated world, and for its capital a physically resurrected city. And today, and leading in tomorrow, we're going to talk about this resurrected land and resurrected city. Ezekiel chapter 40. Let's get ourselves caught up here. Ezekiel chapter 40 begins the detailed vision of a future temple to be erected in the earth, along with details regarding its worship service, as well as specific information regarding the inheritance of the land. We are given the exact date of this final vision to Ezekiel in verse 1. It states, "In the 25th year, in the beginning of the year, in the 10th day of the month." Now by itself, that may not seem like very pertinent information. At the time of the vision, it had been 25 years since Ezekiel had been taken captive, and 14 years since Jerusalem had been destroyed. But why are we told the exact day and year of the vision? As we know, Ezekiel was a man of sign, as we are told in Ezekiel chapter 4. Ezekiel was a man of sign. The vision takes place during a jubilee year, or during the 50th year of release, as outlined in Leviticus 25. 50 years had passed since King Josiah kept a solemn Passover, which is considered to be a jubilee celebration for a 50-year time span, 49 years, 50 years. The 10th day of the first month began the preparation of the Passover by selecting a lamb for sacrifice. The Passover represented Israel's deliverance from bondage and death, destruction of their enemies, the passing over of their sins, and the beginning of a new year. The previous points and the giving of this date and time by Ezekiel as to the opening up of this vision, the previous points indicate to us the opening of the millennial age, that it will be marked as a jubilee year, which will coincide with the following momentous occasions to be celebrated. The following momentous occasions to be celebrated. First of all, the completion of the temple, which will include a solemn Passover, as indicated by the time period that Ezekiel gives us with the opening up of this vision. He was seeing in vision the opening up of this millennial age, of this great temple. The second point, and we're going to spend a little bit more time here, is that this will be the second appointment of Christ as king, as well as officiating high priest over the new temple. Now, what do we mean by the second appointment? If we could go over to 1 Chronicles, go to the 28th and 29th chapter. The 29th chapter is where we're really going to focus, but look at the 28th chapter. In the 28th and 29th chapter of 1 Chronicles is a beautiful account of a national assembly that was called by David shortly before his death. There, he dedicated materials, blueprints for the building of the temple, and instructions for its service. And the temple that we are talking about is the temple that Solomon constructed. He called for Israel's continued obedience to God in order to preserve their inheritance of the land. There he offered up profound words of praise to God. Thine, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty, for all that is in the heaven and in the earth is thine. Thine is the kingdom, O Lord, and thou art exalted as head above all. There they offered sacrifice. And when we arrive to chapter 29, verse 22 in this narrative, we read, and they made Solomon, the son of David, king the second time, and anointed him unto the Lord to be the chief governor, and Zadok to be priest. We know that the first time that Solomon was anointed king was under duress of rebellion. And so this is the official appointing, we might say, or official celebration that is put in place. Then Solomon sat on the throne of the Lord as king instead of David his father, and prospered, and all Israel obeyed him. And all the princes and the mighty men and all the sons likewise of King David submitted themselves unto Solomon the king. And the Lord magnified Solomon exceedingly in the sight of all Israel, and bestowed upon him such royal majesty as had not been on any king before in Israel. We know that when Christ returns, and when Jerusalem is rescued, Christ will assume his position as king. But it will be at this time, at this great Jubilee celebration, that he will be anointed a second time with great joy and worldwide understanding of what is going on. Might we not simply insert Christ instead of Solomon in this passage, with the exception of Christ as chief governor and high priest, and the sons of Zadok for the priesthood? Is it not safe to deduce that this typifies an even greater assembly at the beginning of the millennial reign? Except in the latter instance, the temple will be completed. We ask the question, will David himself be honored to officiate and speak, just as he did for Solomon? We don't know the answer to that. We will see. And hopefully we will be there to see it. And no doubt, David most certainly will be there. In this great Jubilee year, we will see the completed transition of all governmental and religious influence under Christ, including all last vestiges of mystic Babylon purged from the earth. We will see the national rebirth of Israel complete, with Ephraim and Judah united under their king and in their land. We also will see a new standard of measuring time. And we're quoting from Brother Henry Sauliffe out of his book regarding the temple. He says, we will be this Jubilee will be the commencement of a new age in which official records will date not from the year of our Lord, nor from the reign of some Gentile king, nor from Jehoiakim's captivity, but from the day defined in the division itself, when the offerings of the Israelitish people are once again accepted, and peace shall reign with all the inhabitants of the earth, both Jew and Gentile. The ushering in of the new age will involve the realization of one of its primary promises, the inheritance of the land and Jerusalem in its midst. The inheritance of the land and Jerusalem in its midst. The primary elements of a kingdom, and there are actually, there's a longer list, but we will keep it a little bit short. The primary elements of a kingdom are its king, its subjects, and its territory. Though the dominion of the kingdom and age to come is in fact global, we understand from scriptures that its supreme nation is Israel, as was considered last night, and that its core is the transformed city of Jerusalem. So its supreme nation is Israel, and its core is the transformed city of Jerusalem. Now, we need to be careful in our consideration of the kingdom, not to use the present status of things as a window into our view of the kingdom age itself. Now, if we look, and what we mean by this is if we look at the territorial boundaries that we have now, this is what we have Israel in the current form. Now, yes, the current secular restoration of the land has brought about significant changes in agriculture and forestry. This is true. Okay, but we know that there's more to come. But here's the territorial boundaries as we see them now. Here is the territorial boundaries of the age to come. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. Here's the city of Jerusalem now. Here is Jerusalem of the future. Now, things are to change and to change dramatically. And again, yes, the current secular restoration of the land has brought about significant changes in agriculture and forestry. Comparing the dismal reports of those like Mark Twain who visited Palestine in the 1800s, there has been a miraculous turnaround brought about in the land over the last 100 years to the efforts of the Jewish inhabitants, but again, with God's hand behind the scenes. But this is not a complete fulfillment of prophecy and is simply a small token of things to come. We also have to remember that the devastation of the Gogian invasion will no doubt cause some cataclysmic reversals to the land and its cities, as well as the earthquake that will dramatically affect the region. All we have to do is a small example of that is look at Gaza. And when Israel turned Gaza over to the so-called Palestinians, what was really a thriving and beautiful city is absolutely trashed at this point. It's a slum. So it doesn't take much to reverse the work that has been done. And we understand that the inheritance will expand dramatically into territories east of the Jordan River and into Arabia that are currently desolate and require the miraculous hand of Yahweh for their rejuvenation. Speaking to the restored condition of the land during the millennial age, we have scriptures and hymns, beautiful hymns, that speak to its transformation into a paradise, unseen since the creation of the earth. We're going to go through these verses fairly quickly. Isaiah 51 and 3. He will comfort all her waste places, and he will make her wilderness like Eden, and her desert like the garden of the Lord. Ezekiel 36 and 35. And they shall say, this land that was desolate is become like the garden of Eden, and the waste and desolate and ruined cities are become fenced and are inhabited. Then the heathen that are left round about you shall know that I, the Lord, build the ruined places and plant that was desolate. I, the Lord, have spoken it, and I will do it. I will do it. Isaiah 4 and 2. And the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. Isaiah 35 and 1. The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them. And the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. The restored nature of the land will coincide with a blessed an enlightened state of its inhabitants. A blessed and enlightened state of its inhabitants. Still in Isaiah 35, 5 and 6. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as an hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing. No doubt there is a natural application to this, but we especially view a spiritual application, and here is the enlightening of the eyes of the masses, especially of the children of Israel. Isaiah 33 and 24, the inhabitant shall not say, I am sick. So health greatly increased. Isaiah 65, 19, verse 20, and also verse 23. The voice of weeping shall be no more heard in her, nor the voice of crying. There shall be no more thence an infant of days, nor an old man that hath not filled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old. They shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth for trouble. They shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth for trouble. We think about in our own lives at this time and how we labor. Sometimes that laboring feels like it's simply in vain. 65 and 24 of Isaiah. And it shall come to pass that before they call, I will answer. And while they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together. And the lion shall eat straw like the bullock. And dust shall be the serpent's meat. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, saith the Lord. Again, a beautiful natural picture in this, but we can't help but think that there is also a spiritual application to this, especially in regard to the serpent's meat. Jeremiah 31, verses 31 through 34. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Verse 33, but this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my law in their inward parts and write in their hearts and will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall teach no more every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord. For they shall all know me, from the least of them unto the greatest of them, saith the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity and I will remember their sin no more. That's an important passage and something that else that will come up here either today or tomorrow. The Jewish people will be set on an enormous land grant as promised to Abraham's seed after the flesh. Positioned between the Mediterranean and the river of Egypt to the east, to the west, the Euphrates River, it will be apportioned in parallel strips, as outlined in Ezekiel 47 and 48. It will dwarf the tiny partition granted them by the United Nations, and that which they have gained through war since 1948. This will be a country not granted by the United Nations, but by God Himself. We see a country whose borders will explode from the current 8,500 square miles, not including the West Bank, to an inheritance of approximately 300,000 square miles. Isaiah 26 and 15 declares, thou hast increased the nation, O Lord. Actually, let's look that up. Isaiah 26 and 15. Isaiah 26 and 15. Isaiah 26 and 15. We read in the Authorized Version, thou hast increased the nation, O Lord. Thou hast increased the nation. Thou art glorified. Thou hast removed it far unto all the ends of the earth. This to remove far actually is to enlarge or extend all the boundaries of the land. So thou hast increased the nation, O Lord. Thou hast increased the nation. Thou art glorified. Thou hast enlarged or extended all the boundaries of the land. Brother Thomas wrote in Elpis Israel, and we have it in the lower portion of this screen. Here then is a noble domain, lying between Assyria, Persia, Arabia, the Red Sea, Egypt, and the Mediterranean, capable, when peopled by an industrious, enlightened, and well and strongly governed nation, of commanding the commerce and sovereignty of Asia and the wealth of Europe and America. Such is the land concerning which God said to Abram, to thee will I give it, and unto thy seed ever. We will note that in the tribal allotments, that the sons of Rachel and Leah are placed towards the center, nearest what is called the Holy Oblation in Jerusalem, while the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah are furthest away. Seven tribes to the north, seven being the number of completeness as well as the covenant number, and five tribes to the south, five being the number of grace. So we see in this completeness in God's covenant through His grace for Israel after the flesh. Completeness in God's covenant through His grace. Each tribe in their place, each allotment will be ruled over by the 12 apostles. There, in the land, a people that were once scattered, ridiculed, persecuted, and executed as standing on the fringe of society will be the very center of world culture, influence, and power. Now we know that the Jews play a very prominent role, a very begrudging prominent role, at least to the Gentiles, in this present order of things. But of course, in the kingdom age, the Gentile hearts will have a very different view of Jewish influence. Those of the nations that come up to Jerusalem to worship will see the prosperity that the Jews will then enjoy, if not themselves, serving their needs. Let's go to Isaiah 61. Isaiah 61, verses 5 through 7. We're told here, "And strangers shall stand and feed your flocks, and the sons of the alien shall be your plowmen and your vine dressers. But ye shall be named the priest of the Lord. Men shall call you the ministers of our God. Ye shall eat the riches of the Gentiles, and in the glory shall ye boast yourselves. For your shame ye shall have double, and for confusion they shall rejoice in their portion. Therefore in their land they shall possess the double. Everlasting joy shall be unto them." Now we believe that this has a reference to both natural Israel, but also to spiritual Israel as well. And we'll come back to that. Now, the Holy Oblation, what is referred to as the Holy Oblation? And those arrows, don't be confused by the arrows. We have those placed in certain spots. Beersheba to the south, Hebron in the middle, and then Bethel at the top. The red arrow, of course, is the place of the sanctuary of Jerusalem. And then the green arrow is the Yahweh Shammah city. And we'll get to that shortly. Included in this land grant is a central portion, which is referred to as an oblation, or a heave offering. We were listening to Brother Lou, and I know that we all were. He made reference to this heave offering. This heave offering that you shall offer unto the Lord. It measures 25,000 reeds in breadth and width, which is approximately 50 miles on each side. The reed itself, the measuring standard of this future temple and of this land grant, the reed itself is the standard of measure, and it carries a figurative meaning. The reed is a symbol of rulership, and the crown as a symbol of royalty, both which were given Christ in mockery before his crucifixion. Brother Sully, in his Ezekiel's Temple book, observes, and I quote, let me pull this up here, "The constituents of the spiritual house, Hebrews 3 and 6, have already been referred to under the symbol of a woven line of flax. Now this spiritual temple, i.e. the temple of the Spirit, is constructed according to a certain standard of measure. That measure is Christ. For so Paul informs us in Ephesians 4, 3, Colossians 3 and 10. A measuring reed, therefore, is an apt figure of Christ in whom are all, or whom are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge and in whom all fullness dwells." So the reed is the fullness and fullness and measure of Christ. The holy oblation is divided into three sections as outlined in Ezekiel 48 and also 45 as well. First of all is the north division. The north division. 10,000 reeds in depth, approximately 20 miles. This portion is given to the immortal priest, or the sons of Zadok. The sanctuary, temple, is told to be in the midst thereof, or in the middle of this portion. Second is a place of the same dimensions given to the mortal or Levitical priest to the south of the Zadokian portion. Only 5,000 reeds in depth, or approximately 10 miles, will be a profane, common, or unholy place for a city, the Yahweh Shammah city, which we'll consider more in a moment. Standing on each side of the city will be about 200 square miles on each side, which is portioned for gardens to supply the food needs of the city. Now, so far we have mentioned the 12 tribes, the place of the sanctuary, the allotment for the immortal priesthood, and the allotment for the mortal Levites. But what about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to who these promises were made? They walked through it, but never did receive their inheritance. As Stephen declared regarding Abraham, not so much to set his foot on, yet he promised that he would give it to him for a possession. Though the land in its totality will be considered theirs, there is enough information provided us to give us plausible reason to perceive the place of the residence. And I've always find this extremely, extremely interesting. And I'm not going to be dogmatic about it, but I think the suggestions of Brother Sully are valid. Brother Sully proposed for Abraham that his residence will be at Hebron. At Hebron. For Isaac, it will be at Beersheba, and Jacob, to the north, at Bethel. All three in the confines of the holy oblation. Now, he makes mention of this in his book on the temple, but we actually are referencing in our consideration of this a series of articles he wrote for the Christadelphian, specifically his fourth installment that appears in the November 1880 issue, which actually provides some additional information. I think some things were cut in editing to put in the book, but there's some interesting tidbits that are provided in the series of articles that didn't make it into the final book. For Abraham, why would it be, or why would we even consider it to be Hebron? For Abraham, though at first making an altar at Bethel, later after his separation from Lot, the Lord commanded him in Genesis 13, verses 14 through 18. It states, Lift up now thine eyes and look from the place where thou art, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it and to thy seed forever. After he received the promise, he removed his tent to Hebron, which indicates fellowship or association. From Hebron would provide a better vantage point in which to see the land. And there he built an altar. For Isaac, after being commanded not to go down to Egypt and to dwell in a land that God would show him in Genesis 26, after a series of providential run-ins, and we put the emphasis on the word providential, after a series of providential run-ins with the Gentiles over the wells that Isaac had dug, a very trying time for him because he kept getting kicked out of each one of those, he finally ended up at Beersheba, the well of the oath. Upon his arrival, God appeared to him, renewing the promise, and there Isaac built an altar, and his servants dug a well. He pitched his tent there and made a covenant of peace with his Gentile antagonist, Abimelech. He made peace with the Gentiles. Beersheba would put Isaac in close proximity to the Yahweh Shammah city in the south. For Jacob, much is focused upon his overnight stay at Bethel, and I understand that Brother Lou is going to speak more regarding Bethel. For Jacob, much is focused upon his overnight stay at Bethel after fleeing his home from the wrath of Esau. There at Bethel, he had the dream vision of a ladder or stairway reaching to heaven. This was a vision connecting the time of Jacob to the time when Christ will sit on his throne. There God promised to him that the land whereon thou liest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed. Now Sully makes this interesting comment. Bethel, and this again is out of that fourth installment that appears in the November 1880 Christadelphian. He says, Bethel, due north of the sanctuary in the most holy portion, is a convenient place from which to see the manifestation of Yahweh on Mount Zion and to witness the arrival and departure of those messengers who will no doubt continually move to and from the temple during the time when the Son of Man is enthroned in Jerusalem. Contemplating these things by the Spirit, Jacob exclaimed, there is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. I think that's an interesting observation. Whether you agree or disagree, that's fine, but that's something that struck me. But there is still territory unaccounted for. East and west of the Holy Oblation lies an enormous tract of land. For what purpose is it? We read from Ezekiel 48 and 21. Let's turn over there. Ezekiel 48 and 21. And we read there, and the residue shall be for the prince on the one side and on the other side. The prince. Remembering that Christ is the singular seed of the Abrahamic covenant, that he is in fact the covenant sacrifice itself by which the covenant was confirmed, that he is the son of David to whom every knee should bow. It is most fitting that he receives the choicest land available in the midst of the land of Israel. Christ will receive his portion. Let's go to Zechariah chapter 2. Zechariah chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. For we read, "And many nations shall be joined to the Lord in that day, and shall be my people. And I will dwell in the midst of thee. And thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me unto thee. And the Lord shall inherit Judah, his portion in the Holy Land, and shall choose Jerusalem again." This is an amazing detail in the prophetic record. Should Christ be the heir of the vineyard, but yet find no possession in it? Should he inherit the throne of David and be the king of the entire earth, but yet have no place of his own in its inheritance? We know the answer to that because the scriptures reveal to us that in fact, he has his inheritance. Regarding this inheritance by the prince, Brother Roberts had a very interesting observation here. Let's see if I have that quote in place here. Yes. Brother Roberts observed in his booklet or pamphlet, Christ on Earth Again, he says, "A stately realm in the land of promise, stretching far enough east to embrace the original Garden of Eden, when the first Adam was expelled, is assigned to the last Adam." Let me repeat that. I just like the way that's stated. "A stately realm in the land of promise, stretching far enough east to embrace the original Garden of Eden, when the first Adam was expelled, is assigned to the last Adam as the palace of his glory on earth, the retreat of his loving communion with the bride, the Lamb's wife." This significant and what may seem to us as a passing detail adds to the powerful reality of what is coming on the earth. We have plenty of information as to Christ's position as king, but to be granted insight into the practical matter of Christ's personal abode and intimate possession is quite a blessing to consider. Will we be granted audience into this special retreat of our elder brother to have communion with him during this millennial age? Again, we make the answer now. Now we consider the Yahweh Shammah city. This is described in Ezekiel 48, verses 15 through 19, and also verse 35. It is within the southern third of the holy oblation, but it is referenced as a profane or common place. It is to be serviced by all the tribes of Israel. Therefore, we are not being informed here of the temple city of Jerusalem. It is something different. Verse 35 of that 48th chapter refers to it as Yahweh Shammah, or Yahweh is there or thither. Brother Graydon, in talking about the 23rd Psalm, I think it's either in the third or fourth verse, where actually Yahweh Shammah is in that portion of that Psalm. Yahweh is not manifested in this profane city, but thither in location, over at Jerusalem. Now I know I'm taking liberties with this. But what we did is we took just a picture and then took a picture of the temple and tried to overlay into this from about a 20-mile distance from the Yahweh Shammah city if we were looking north. I don't know that from the Yahweh Shammah city that you will be able to see the temple, but we're suggesting maybe that it will be possible. But from a 20-mile distance, the reason we put it together like this, and there's a place south of our house, not very far, that we can actually, it's a high point in the county where we can actually see a 20-story tower, which is 15 miles away in downtown Springfield. What we're looking at here is about 20 miles away. And we know that the corner towers of the tabernacle will be over 40 stories, so I may have actually had a little bit too far distant. I don't know. But just to give it some perspective. So the Lord over there, or thither. So from the vantage point of the city, the temple, Yahweh's dwelling place, is thither. Thither simply means to or towards that place, that place. Jerusalem will sit some 20 miles to the north. The city itself is 4,500 reed square, or almost 9 miles on each side. A residue is spoken of as extending 10,000 reeds eastward and 10,000 westward, almost 20 miles in each direction, devoted to the supply of food. So we clearly are speaking of a specially suited city that lies within the holy oblation, but is itself devoted to the more common necessities of life. It will be a city of lodging, as it is serviced by the 12 tribes, but of no mention of them being residences or resident of it. Sully again stated regarding this city, "The city may be likened to a huge garden city hotel in which are received all those who visit the temple. Here the people who come from all parts of the earth to hear the wisdom of the greater than Solomon and to pay their vows unto the Most High would be entertained. The city is large enough for such a purpose, 18,000 reeds, or about 41 statute miles in circuit. If all go up from it to worship the Lord enthroned in the temple, its appropriate designation would be the Lord thither, or the Lord from this place." End of quote. It is from here that a pilgrimage is staged that will eventually lead the worshipers to the temple of Jerusalem. Let's read from Ezekiel 39, verses 11 through 16. Ezekiel 39, verses 11 through 16. "And it shall come to pass in that day that I will give unto Gog a place there of graves in Israel, the valley of the passengers on the east of the sea, and it shall stop the noses of the passengers, and there shall they bury Gog and all his multitude, and they shall call it the valley of Haman Gog. And 7 months shall the house of Israel be bearing of them, that they may cleanse the land. Yea, all the people of the land shall bury them, and it shall be to them a renown the day that I shall be glorified, saith the Lord. And they shall sever out men of continual employment passing through the land to bury with the passengers those that remain upon the face of the earth to cleanse it. After the end of 7 months shall they search. And the passengers that pass through the land, when any seeth a man's bone, then shall he set up a sign by it till the buriers have buried it in the valley of Haman Gog. And also the name of the city shall be Hamona. Thus shall they cleanse the land." We're putting special emphasis on this being the valley of the passengers, to pass through, traverse on the east of the sea. I'm hitting this subject kind of at an awkward time. We'll probably have to postpone full consideration till tomorrow. But as described in Ezekiel 39 and 11, as the valley of the passengers to pass through, traverse on the east of the sea. We understand from the scriptures that those who are coming to visit the temple will not go just straight north from the Yahweh Shammah city, but will have a special pathway that is charted out for them. A pathway of memorial. Moving northward, they will swing around they will come from the south side, of the, what we now call the Dead Sea, over towards the east of that sea, and will go due north. Moving northward, they then swing around the northern side and come towards Jerusalem from a northeastern direction. Now, knowing that the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, why will such a detour be required? As we understand it, it will act as a parabolic lesson that will teach of the destruction of the wicked and the hope and salvation that is extended to the nations. It will act as a parabolic lesson that will teach of the destruction of the wicked and the hope and salvation that is extended to the nations. I think it best probably that we stop there, and we'll tie this in with the worship of the age to come as well. So we'll stop at that point for now. Thank you very much.